This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to the Drill Down, the business stories behind stocks on the move. Today is July 20. This is episode 56. Well, just ahead, IBM has a mediocre earnings report, which is about as good as this company can do, but it might be worse than it looks. And can Iridium sell marine units to ships stuck at port? And we'll take a peek under the hood of edge computing giant Fastly with our guest, Fastly CEO Joshua Bixby. Really interesting conversation. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
Try listening to the show, The Drill Down, on your favorite home speaker. That's right. You can go to your smart speaker and say something like, "Hey, Alexa, play the Drill Down podcast," and just listen to what happens.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at Drill Down Pod, and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
Well, I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to the Drill Down. We explain the business stories behind stocks on the move. Joining me, as always, Ben Wilson, our editor. He's always here. You don't always get to hear him, but today you're lucky. Ben, how are you?
It's nice to be kind of in front of the scenes instead of behind the scenes today, Corey.
We're glad to have you, of course.
All right, let's get to it.
Yeah.
Tell me the three most important developments in the world of business today.
Well, let's start with the market. I normally don't like to have the market report because I usually don't think what happens in the market any given day matters that much. Then yesterday I said, all right, we're down. Market's down 1.5%, the S&P 500. I guess it's a story. Well, I guess it wasn't because it's up 1.5% today. So maybe it was a sound and fury signifying nothing. Yes, there is concern about the Delta variant of coronavirus. And yes, oil prices will be affected by increased production from OPEC. But the market almost right back to where it was to start the week after two exciting sessions way down. Right back up again. So maybe, I don't know, Ben, do I have to change that threshold of 1.5% to say it matters?
No, I love that our reporting on this is mostly that it is not a news story. And as today, it has continued to not be
the news.
A news story.
No news. Now moving on. Let's get to story number two. The U.S. and Germany have reached out an agreement. We're just talking about, right, OPEC, more production. Well, the U.S. and Germany have finally reached an agreement allowing for the controversial Russian natural gas pipeline to be completed, that deal over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline of pumping Russian gas. And it was, you know, controversial because it might help Russia, but it also might help continue to lower the cost of petrochemicals in this world. And apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, a deal has been reached. And then finally, third most important story. Maybe this is another non-story, Ben. I want your take. Jeff Bezos and three passengers get to the edge of space, actually get to what is generally considered outer space at 60 miles above the Earth, actually get to 62, with three passengers and coming back 11 minutes, $1 billion or more. They're hoping it's going to start some era of human space travel. And Jeff looked real happy afterwards. What's your take on that? Is that a business story? Is that just a billionaire spending a lot of money?
I suppose this is the, if you follow the rest of the business news, this is the second billionaire in space story in a couple weeks. But it does seem like this time he flew over the infamous Karaman line. Am I pronouncing that right? He got the required 60-something miles into call it actual space.
I will tell you, the first person to talk to me about that line was, in fact, Richard Branson. So It used to matter to him more than it matters to Branson now. But is there a business story? Let's put the cash register. If you hear a cash register ring, it's a business story. And could there be a business someday of taking people to space? I suppose. I was sitting in a coffee shop this morning saying, you know, Richard Branson's got a plan to put 600 people in space over the course of the next 3 years or so. I'm sitting in a coffee shop that probably puts 600 people into coffee in about 5 days. That's not a national business story. So it's a cool science story. It's a cool adventure story. I don't know if it's a business story. I'd much prefer that he maybe pays as much taxes as we do. I'm thinking of ProPublica's reporting that showed that the rate of taxes that Jeff Bezos has been paying is somewhere less than 1% of his wealth. That might be more interesting to me than flying to space. And maybe even better for this country. Who knows?
Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Let us start with Iridium.
Iridium, that trades with the ticker IRDM. Shares were up 9% today, and for the last 12 months, shares are up 55%. What's the story with Iridium?
Yeah, so 55%, let's compare that to 32% for the S&P 500. That's pretty good performance. So this company has an array of satellites, and they allow for satellite phones to work where other phones will not. They've got a really interesting and a really big marine business. They sell complicated systems to allow for all sorts of devices to be tracked, and even the future, perhaps the future of IoT devices, monitoring what ships are doing and installing these big systems on ships and then the ability to track them. But, you know, so they reported a quarter and they had quarterly earnings today. It was a pretty good quarter. But what do we know about shipping right now, right? That ships aren't going anywhere and that ships are stuck in port. And the question is, does the problems in the global shipping environment and the supply chain have an impact on activations of Iridium devices? Here's Matt Detsch, the CEO of Iridium today.
Right now, we don't think it's going to impact our growth much in the second half in terms of activations and obviously service revenue, because we called that up for the year, because most of our partners have the devices they need in the next quarter or two, or certainly in plans to get those get their current products, you know, fulfilled and everything with their customers. So I really don't think it's going to affect too much. The bigger issue we had more of it was, could we contain it? This is something that a couple really kind of found out about it about a month ago, and I'm really fortunate to have such a great chain team who jumped on this thing really hard, working closely with our supplier, getting kind of increased allocations from what we originally feared, I think, and kind of constrained this thing to primarily two quarters.
So there you have it. The actual problem for them isn't that ships aren't leaving the port. The actual problem here is that they've got they can't get the stuff that's on some of those ships, and they need more equipment.
Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's talk about Big Blue.
Big Blue, a.k.a. IBM, trades with the ticker IBM. Go figure.
Go figure.
Shares were up 1% today, and for the last 12 months are up only 11%. What's going on with IBM?
This company stinks. This company is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. As you mentioned, it was up. It was actually up a little bit more than that earlier in the day. But they reported quarterly earnings. Revenue actually grew. Woohoo! The revenue grew to from $18.12 billion a year ago, a very bad quarter for them. It grew to $18.8 billion. Okay, that's two quarters in a row of revenue growth. Woohoo again, right? Sales down year over year in all but four of the last 34 quarters. So the bar was really low here. And it's not just that sales continue to decline. You know, in 10 years, they've spent $34 billion in acquisitions. And yet their free cash flow is right about where it was 10 years ago. If you gave me $34 billion to spend in acquisitions, I would give you more cash flow than you had 10 years ago. But free cash flow, you know, for example, it's down over what it was 12 months ago on a 12-month trailing basis. But if you adjust it, it's up, which is exactly what CFO Jim Cavanaugh wants us all to focus on, adjusted free cash flow.
We feel very good about where our adjusted free cash flow is through the first half. It's up year to year. really taken into account most of the cash tax head when we talked about 90 days ago is pretty much behind us going forward. So our attainment-wise on adjusted free cash flow, which is really going to be a reflection of both top-line revenue acceleration and operating leverage and margin as we move forward.
So, yeah, I guess if you adjust it, it looks good. If you adjust it, maybe they have that $34 billion back. But in the real world, things are not getting a lot better for IBM.
Corey, I'm a big proponent of somebody giving you $34 billion. I think you would do a much better job managing it.
Let's start a petition. You know, there's a petition online to have Jeff Bezos not come back from outer space. That wasn't very nice. How about we have a petition to have Jeff Bezos give me $34 billion?
Corey, what is your next drill down?
Let's look at Synchrony.
Synchrony trades with the ticker SYF. Shares are up 3% today, and for the last 12 months, shares are up 106%. What's the story with Synchrony?
Well, Synchrony is in the credit card business, and they do a lot of data analysis around their credit cards that's supposed to be better than everyone else's data analysis. I don't know. But I just thought it'd be really interesting to look at these guys. They reported earnings today with a real look at what's happening in the economy, yes, but what's happening with the, you know, as we get to the end of stimulus, as we get to the end of enhanced unemployment benefits, as consumers, you know, what consumers have done during the pandemic is paid down debt and spent less money. And obviously they didn't go out. So the question is, how long can consumers continue to pay down debt and not use credit card? How long are they going to actually start watching their debt balances? And what's that going to mean for Synchrony going forward? Here is Synchrony's CFO, Brian Wenzel.
As we look at savings rates, you know, you clearly see the consumer who increased their savings in the beginning part of the pandemic when stimulus happened, that came back down in line, you know, with historical averages towards the end of 2020. You again saw that lift here in the end of the first quarter into the second quarter with the stimulus actions. We see now across the 29 largest banks that beginning to trail down a little bit. So some of those will come back in line. Clearly with the spending behavior patterns, as well as the increase in the financial obligations as, you know, mortgage forbearance, auto forbearances, and the enhanced unemployment benefits begin to fade here in the back half of the year.
So I thought it was super interesting. Here they're really saying that consumer activity and debt levels are going to come racing right back, and that could probably be good for Synchrony.
Good for Synchrony, but bad for the people going into debt, huh?
Perhaps. I don't know, you can get lots of nice stuff if you borrow enough money. All right, in any case, let's talk of a company that's borrowed a little bit, but Fastly growing company, really interesting approach to pushing computing information and power out to the edge of networks, and was responsible for a massive crash of a good chunk of the internet. We're going to talk to the CEO, Joshua Bixby. It was a really interesting conversation about how to prepare for big problems in your business after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Era's event access and monitoring intelligence platform improves earnings season and the investor events in between through comprehensive calendar tracking, one-click event access, dynamic monitors, multicasting, and more. Powered by an advanced language processing engine, which consumes some 40,000 investor events annually across 10,000 global equities. Learn more at Era, AIERA.com. And remember to join the Drill Down on Twitter and Instagram at Drill Down Pod, and check out our website, bizpod.net, to let us know what stocks you think we should be drilling down on.
And welcome to the Drill Down. We've got a special guest with us today to talk about edge computing and a really interesting and fast-growing company, perfectly named Fastly. Joshua Bixby, the CEO, joins us right now. Joshua, thank you for being with us. Your company appropriately named because you're growing just fantastically compared to, you know, even what you're doing into your IPO only a few years ago.
It is a pleasure to be here, sir. And yes, we are honored by the trust that our customers put in us. We, as you rightly pointed out, we have continued to grow into and through our IPO. I think that's a testament to our customers. We get a chance to work with the best and the brightest and the most technically innovative. And what we're finding is they're growing too, and we get to grow with them.
Yeah. So I asked just about everybody this question. How does your company make money? What do you do?
So we make experiences around the internet fast and secure. And the internet is obviously an important axis upon which the digital world revolves. So a customer like the New York Times, they pay us and they pay us to deliver their website. So, and to secure their website. So when you wake up in the morning and go to the New York Times, you are making a request to a Fastly server. And on that Fastly server, we have all the code and information and knowledge in order to secure that transaction, to make sure it's safe for you and for the company, and then to make sure it's fast and scalable. And so very few of those requests actually ever go back to the origin data center. Most of those requests are served by us. So whether it's the New York Times or it's the Khan Academy or it's Shopify, you know, we are in the business of bringing content close to users, of bringing the code that allows that content to be delivered, because in this personalized world, that, you know, it's not, you don't see the same thing as me. And we bring the layers of security to ensure that that is secure. So we're in the business of delivering your experience everywhere around the world and ensuring that it's fast and secure. We work behind the scenes with the best in the internet.
Yeah, well, and to that, you know, this is sometimes, is this what's referred to as serverless computing?
Correct. Serverless is one of these funny terms, which means almost
because the there are still servers, right?
So I, you know, it would be cool if we didn't have servers to some extent, because they cost money, but and you know, they break like everything else. But yeah, we have servers. The idea of serverless is that our customers don't have to worry about where the servers are and how many servers are there. Our commitment to our customers is to ensure that they don't have to worry about that. So if they have a big spike in Tokyo, we're there. We have the servers there. We've got the capacity there. If tomorrow they have a huge spike in Melbourne, we're there. And so really serverless is this term that has been coined to say somebody else worries about the servers. If I had a chance, I would create different nomenclature.
And yet the notion of not having to deal with servers and just deal with programming is interesting. You guys talk quite a lot about DevOps. Describe to me what DevOps is and why that approach is different than what we what other companies do in the competitors of yours.
Indeed, and it's a profound change that's happening in the industry, and a great sort of place to call out, because in the old days, developers had sort of blinders on. Like, they were told you can work on the web server, the application server, and the database server. Those all sat next to each other in a data center, even a cloud data center. It's like, hey, folks, you can work here. And what developers have always wanted and have always been frustrated with is working with their operations or the IT side of the business. Imagine in the old days, you used to be like, I want to provision a server in Tokyo, and it would take you weeks and you'd fill out paperwork. And like, this took this creative energy that you had and just destroyed it. And so DevOps evolved from this idea of developers who wanted to move quickly, operators who wanted to support developers. And they all, this sort of movement came together. It was like, why are we against each other? Why aren't we supporting each other? Why aren't we building software to make this easy? And so really DevOps is about these two sides stopping a long fought war of bureaucracy, taking all that bureaucracy away and making software elegant and easy. And you know, Amazon's a great example of this. Like, when you log in to create an instance on Amazon, you don't create a ticket. You don't, you know, wait for weeks and get a Gantt chart and a project management plan. You create the server. And that's like the heart of DevOps. And so if you look at Fastly, it's actually not just DevOps. It's actually DevOps and security. Because what we're seeing is, once DevOps got together, and they're not together everywhere, but in the vanguard of the internet, they're together. These teams work together. Right, everything's right. Driven by software. But security still has stood outside of this, where security is like, okay, hold on, folks. I got to do a review. Wait 6 weeks.
So in other words, it's actually all three of them together. A developer creating a program, creating an experience to happen. It used to be they would create the whole experience, and then they would wait for a security review, and the security would then start the code from the ground up and sort of look for holes and problems that could occur and have the whole thing rewritten potentially.
Potentially. And right now, everyone realizes that this has to be a pipeline, seamless. And software has a big role. And so it is developers need to innovate, and the speed of that innovation matters. If you think of this idea of digital transformation, which we all talk about a lot, the reality is, like, at its heart, and I was at a customer boardroom, a virtual boardroom, be it. And, you know, we were talking about digital transformation, and somebody was frustrated by the term. And they're like, listen, here's my fear. Two kids in a basement can innovate faster than my team of 2,000 developers. and innovation matters. And so really at the heart of all of this, it's how can you go quickly? We know that if you move quickly and you iterate, the internet will give you answers as to what works. Most of these companies can't innovate quickly. And the reason that they need to digitally transform and the reason they're scared, and they should be, is that there are people out there who are using these software techniques to innovate hundreds of times an hour or a day. They innovate once every 6 months. You're going to lose. You're just going to lose.
You mean they should be afraid because someone's going to eat your lunch or because someone's going to steal your lunch?
Both.
You're afraid of both. So it's both the hacker and the professional competition.
Both of them are innovating. And I think it's really important on the stealing side, because what we're seeing is the professional hacker is a professional DevOpsSec expert. They are innovating in the same way. And when you have hackers innovating once an hour, and your software is updated once every 3 months, your big appliance gets a batch update once every 3 months, good luck. You can't survive. So what this kind is of all about innovation.
So I'm not a programmer. I don't write software. I make podcasts and other things. And so I wonder what is this process? What is it that needs to be constantly innovated or changed or updated or re-securitized, if you will?
Yeah. So on the security front, think of your software as having, the software that runs any of the websites is having thousands, millions of lines of code. And so in each of those lines of code, there's a potential vulnerability. And so innovators on the hacking side are constantly trying to explore this. And every time you make a change, you introduce both software that will save and secure you. You also introduce software with vulnerabilities. So I think that, I would argue that innovation applies to your business as well. If today you wrote out the headline for every blog and every podcast that you did for the next year, I guarantee you'd be outdated pretty fast, because you have to move with the news and the information that's coming. That's kind of how companies have run their websites. They've said, here's what we're going to do. Here's a 1 year annual plan. Go do it. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work against the bad folks, and it doesn't work for your customers. And so this is all about speed of innovation. And Fastly, at its core, is a platform to speed up innovation and to ensure that it's secure. And that's what we do, for our largest customers. That's our
kind of like, so the model of this year's new Ford Thunderbird doesn't work in software, especially when there's hackers trying to get inside of that new Ford Thunderbird or competitors innovating more quickly. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So your approach in selling to the DevOps instead of selling to the CTO is interesting, because CTOs write bigger checks than the guys in the DevOps department.
Yeah. And so we have to do both. And it's because we're so mission critical. So we actually seed, we have this bottoms up and top down motion. So what we realize is that when we go and run a massive property for a company, a huge website, we are so important to them that the CTO cares. The CTO cares at the New York Times. They care at Stripe. Like they have to care, because we're mission critical. So we actually need both motions. What we find is we are most successful when the organization has from the ground up started to use us, so that when we walk in and talk to that C-level executive, we have all of the support of the individuals underneath it. Give me an example. Like Ticketmaster is a great example. So when we got into Ticketmaster, we got in there because one developer woke up, at midnight and had an inspiration. And you can sign up for Fastly in seconds without, all the bureaucracy of traditional enterprise software. You just can sign up. All of our documentation is available. All our pricing is available. We have tiers that allow you to just try it. Right. So that's totally different than enterprise software. Somebody had an idea of what the ticket experience in the future could look like. They built that in. So by the time this application's even in demo stage, Fastly, because it's programmable, is integrated into all the parts of that application. So the company's not making a decision about Fastly or someone else. The company's making a decision about the future application or the past application. And so that's how we start to move in. So at some point, I got a call from their C-level, myself and Archer, our founder, saying, who are you? Like, you're my shadow edge. You're my shadow edge cloud. I have another one, but every one of my top departments uses you and builds you in from the ground up. How can I trust you? Are you legit? And how can I use more of you? And it's often that conversation goes that way. So I would say, because we're so mission critical, you actually have to have both motions. And that's, the go-to-market motion that we are that we have. And it's something that we think is a bit of a harbinger of how the future is going to look. You're not going to get enterprise software shoved from the top down.
You may not know this, but this is not your first appearance on the Drill Down podcast. We ran a soundbite from you a few weeks ago from a conference you said at the Needham conference back in May.
During the IPO, I was asked questions and still am by media. Like, if Fastly goes down, will we hear about it? And the answer is you'll hear about it when Fastly's back up, because the media that you consume, the websites that tell you this information come down with us. So we are so central to the functioning of the internet that these decisions are not made, even though we have this ground up energy, they're not decisions that are exclusively made by any individual engineer. I mean, often we have to go to the C level.
Well, sure enough, a few weeks later, the internet went down. It Fastly had a problem and the internet went down. So you probably should have knocked on wood at that very moment when you said that.
I probably should have.
But I thought that was prescient of you to realize that, you know, that you really are at this sort of fundamental core or the edge of so many of the networks and how important Fastly is, even though your customer count is somewhat limited.
Yeah, we have 2,000 customers, around 2,000 customers, and we've got, you know, just around 300 enterprise customers. And I think that speaks to the opportunity size. I mean, you know, when you look at this market, there's 120,000 enterprises plus who are buying enterprise software and who need security and scalability and performance. And so it's remarkable at this stage that I look at this opportunity, every day and think, wow, this is bigger than I thought it was the day before. I mean, 300 of 120,000 tells you that there's a lot of runway left here. And I think that's pretty exciting. I mean, we fundamentally believe that this change, this DevOpsec change, this change towards doing more at the edge, and this fundamental idea that you're empowering developers is nascent. It doesn't feel nascent on the West, you know, in some parts of the West Coast, or even in some parts of the East Coast. But when you actually talk to customers, these are ideas that are just starting to come to fruition. So it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was it that happened there when that overnight issue that was pretty quickly resolved, but did in fact cause so much of the media to go down all over the world?
We experienced a global outage. We had an undiscovered software bug that surfaced on June 8th. As you said, we moved quickly to recover that in under an hour, but the outage was broad and severe. And I guess the most important message for me is that our customers trust us. For me, I'm truly sorry about the impact that it had. What happened was, and we detailed this on the blog post, we had this software bug. It went, it's something we hadn't seen before. It went through all of this testing and we missed it. And it was triggered by a very simple configuration that one of our customers performed. It impacted 85% of our servers. And there's a great blog post actually by our SVP of engineering and infrastructure, Nick Rockwell, on the website, which talks about what happened. But more importantly, talks about what we're going to do moving forward. And, I don't want this to happen again. So there are things that we can do to ensure that the internet doesn't have this fragility. And I think anti-fragile is a huge part of what we're looking to build in, what we have historically looked to build in. And this brought more light on areas we need to keep innovating.
What's that like as a leader to have that happen? I mean, everyone makes mistakes. You know, in journalism, there's a long practice tradition of you find a mistake, you correct it, you let your readers, listeners, viewers know about it, and you own up to it. And yet, even today, after hundreds of years of this practice, of this craft of journalism, there are those who try to skirt around these issues of corrections and so on. But you're in some uncharted territory. What's that like as a leader when that sort of, that must have been an unpleasant phone call at a certain hour?
3 o'clock in the morning, actually. I got a call at 3, and then I get a call 30 seconds later from a reporter.
No kidding.
As I'm, wiping the sleep out of my eyes and getting up. It's certainly, from my perspective, one of those calls that keeps you up at night. I mean, as I say, our commitment to our customers and just to the world is that we're going to be here for them. And when we don't deliver, it's scary. The first question always is this an attack? And I think that, you sort of have this binary sort of decision-making tree, like, is this an attack or is this something else? We have such great people and systems so that we knew immediately that this was something that was not attack-based in the first 10 minutes. So that's, you sort of have different classes of this. I think, I feel a little helpless in those situations. I want to help. I'm not a coder, so I can't help. And so I'm kind of a bystander trying to support the teams. You know, we have worked for years to build our incident response. And it's one of the reasons that we're able to mitigate this so quickly is because we practice this. We have playbooks for this. We have people who specialize in this. And, you know, even though it happened at 3 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, you know, one of the advantages of our business is that we are around the sun. We are incredibly remote friendly. So we don't have people necessarily getting out of bed. And so we have a lot of things that help us mitigate it, but at a personal level, it's scary. And, you know, you understand that these have a pretty significant impact on the core commitment. I think to your point, one of the things that I'm really proud about at Fastly is there's no skirting of the issue. You know, within minutes, we have an update telling people there's something wrong. Within an hour, we are very clearly taking, you know, we've mitigated the problem. We've taken full ownership of it. Within a day, we have, you know, a blog post and we have an FSA, which describes the incident in more detail. 24 hours after that, we have an update with everything we've learned. So one of the things that I'm so proud about in our business is the core values of transparency. This is a mistake. We made it. It was not something a customer made. They happened to trigger it. We shouldn't be making those things. And we take full responsibility for it. There's no skirting of the issue here. This is on us and we're going to get better.
I want to get back to something you said. You said you practice for this?
We do. Yes, sir.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, when you run mission critical infrastructure for the internet, the expectation from our customers is not that we're going to be perfect. The expectation is that we're going to have systems in place to mitigate mistakes. And I think what's wonderful about our customer base is they're developers too. They make mistakes too. And you know, I can't tell you how many calls I was on, both in the day of the incident and the days after, where people were just, you know, I was on this great call with a CTO of one of the largest companies in the world. He said, "What can we learn from you? We don't usually do this in an hour. I'd love to learn how you did it and how you mitigated it." And so I think, you know, we practice. And one of the things we do in practicing is really work with our systems to make sure they work. We exercise these systems. So, sometimes we practice. We don't tell everyone. So people think it's real. Sometimes we practice and warn people.
Fire drills.
Yes, sir. Tabletops and fire drills. It's critical to getting this work. You don't want to practice this on a high severity issue for the first time. It's like anything. You know, I think of this like the fire department. They don't come to a big apartment fire for the first time. They have their craft, and part of our craft is remediation of issues. That's part of the craft of running something at this scale.
Fastly, indeed. I will say I was surprised and impressed at how quickly that happened. How quickly you fixed those problems. Interesting company. We appreciate your time. Josh Bixby, CEO of Fastly. Well, coming up next on the drill down, we're going to have the drill down bite. That one number that means a whole lot. That number is going to explain something about Fastly's business. I think it's going to surprise you when the drill down continues.
The drill down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And we hope you listen to the drill down in whatever your favorite podcast platform is. But when you do so, go up into the menu or click the button so you subscribe and follow us. That way you can make sure you catch every show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following @drilldownpod and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
All right, we've got the drill down bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. We were talking about Fastly and just how much their customers are spending, even though the tends to walk in the door with a single engineer who sees it as a solution to a problem. The average Fastly customer in the last quarter spent $800,000 with Fastly. That's up from $782,200 the previous quarter. So there's that bite, $800,000 per customer for Fastly, a fast-growing business indeed.
That is not quite a low monthly subscription price for a quality service.
Well, if you got so many people using it, it's not such a bad deal, I guess, if it's working to get that computing at the edge of the network. I'm on my edge. I'm on my own last nerve. Time to go. Thank you for listening to The Drill Down. I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster is our executive producer, and Ben Wilson is our editor extraordinaire. The Drill Down is a production of the Business Podcast Network.